Spirit Radio Podcasts.
So, tell you what, we've got Katrina Lynch in studio, and of course we were chatting away there, Gutto, and forgetting about what was going on. How's it going there, Katrina? We're always looking at parenting and family in this particular slot, but this is a particular week because this is the week that people go back to school and some people start school for the first time. Uh-huh. And there's a lot of issues. And really, I think, you know, you frame it really well when you use the phrase back to school anxiety.
Yeah.
So tell us all about that.
Okay, so anxiety is a good word, but it sums up a whole cauldron or a tsunami, if you want to.
Sure, tsunami is right.
A tsunami of emotions, okay? And I was listening to your little news slot, you know, there, your Vox Pop, you know, and the lady was saying about the kids doing her head in, and he says, well, she's doing my head in.
Yeah, exactly. Well, this is good. It just made me laugh.
I thought, how funny, you know. And there are a whole load of mixed emotions because I was actually the opposite when my kids were going back, because I just loved the freedom of the summer. Now, I don't want to kind of paint a picture of me being super mom of the year.
No, but I know what you mean, though. I was the same. I had a little moment the other day. I hate when they go back to school.
I love family. Yeah. And because I was so blessed to be able to stay at home with my children, that I didn't have to go out and work. You know, that I got to spend so much time with them and all that sort of stuff.
And my own mum used to say the same thing. She used to say, you know, she'd nearly cry whenever they go back to school.
Oh, I would.
Because my mum was a big extrovert and she loved having people around her and she loved the family.
Well, now you have me bottled, you know.
Yeah.
And but, you know, there are advantages as well. There's something good about getting back to normal and everything. So the thing of it is, we're all getting back to normal, whatever your definition of normal is.
Exactly.
But the thing of it is, routine is good for all of us, whether we like it or not. But you have people who are delighted that they're getting back to normal and routine and everything, so there's a certain relief for them. You've got people, and all in the same family, who are dreading going back to normal and getting up early and making school lunches and getting into
Absolutely.
All the extracurricular activity, and they're crying in their hankies and all that sort of stuff. And that's only the parents.
You know,
and then you add on children, maybe, and concerns and anxieties and all that sort of stuff about starting school, going back to school, seeing friends, will I have friends, all that sort of stuff. Okay, and anxiety comes from a sense of, can I cope?
Yeah,
can
exactly.
Am I going to be all right?
Yeah.
Okay, so a little bit of self-talk for parents is very helpful at this stage. I remember my first child going to school, and there had been a poem, I can't even remember who wrote it, it might have been Frank O'Connor or something or other, you know.
Yeah.
And it was about the mammy dropping the son at the door, and he came home a man. You know, this sort of stuff, you know. And like a fool, I read it, and I lived it, and I cried it, and everything.
Yeah.
And do you know what? We're really better off not letting our heads go in there. You
right.
know, I often point to my head and say, this is a dangerous place, you know, and I really need to be very careful before I go in there. People have died in there.
So you're into the catastrophization immediately.
Exactly. So, you know, have a little bit of self-talk with yourself. OK. And even to say, you know, things like, this, okay, it's emotionally challenging because change is challenging, and I might be the type of person who likes this and doesn't like that, and my child may be the same, but it'll be okay.
Yeah.
It's going to be
okay. I'll be okay.
I will be okay,
and
will be okay, and they will come home at whatever time it is, and I'll be able to give them a hug or whatever it is, and this is just a different phase of life. The summer was lovely, and it had its benefits. I am still with all the people I love, and it's just different.
Yeah.
I love the bit, I've often said this before, I'm rambling now this morning, but there you go.
No, rambling beautifully. You keep going.
There's, you know, a requiem service, and one of the lines in it, for your faithful people, Lord, life has changed. not ended. And I often say that to myself, and I just say, this is a change, but it's all part of life and a very good part of life. So there you go. You chat to yourself, go and have a talk, and maybe kind of say to yourself, a very good sentence to say to yourself is, what am I afraid of? Or what am I worried about? Sometimes we're going around and we have an emotion inside us and we're thinking,
We haven't even named it yet.
Exactly.
Yeah,
so
very
if you
good.
Say, and you can usually track it back and kind of say, well, I'm worried about getting up early, or I'm worried about, will I be able to, And make a little plan then and say, okay, maybe I need to get up 15 minutes earlier. You know,
yeah.
I can do that. Or maybe I need to organise lunches a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
I can do that.
I was going to say to you, you know, and I'm going to just use one picture. But, you know, a picture or a thought, both of them can be very deeply disturbing for somebody. And it's very important that we don't really try to, you know, to almost give in to that thought. You have to fight it. You have to stop it. It's the, you know, and I'm going to give you one. The idea of picturing your little five-year-old eating their lunch on their own. And that's the kind of thing that really, really sends people. And it's such a trigger for a mum and a dad, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, if you leave that thought there unchallenged, it will absolutely play havoc with you for hours on end.
Yes, yes.
Well, don't you agree?
Will. I agree. And having taught myself, having children who are teachers, and having friends who are teachers, talk to the teacher. Okay, I know there may be something has grown up about, oh, teachers don't want to talk to parents. It is difficult to talk to parents who are complaining.
Mm.
You know, there's no doubt about that, you know, or who feel that their child isn't getting enough attention. But the teacher is on your child's side. And if you have concerns, do voice them to the teacher.
Oh.
You know, and just go to the teacher and say, look, this is my first child at school, this is my umpteenth child at school, whatever, or they are, you know, a loner, they're reserved, they're this, that, the other. This is my concern. It may be unrealistic, it may be on whatever, you know. And I've had teachers ring me up and say, Johnny's fine. He's sitting out there now and he's chatting away, or he's kicking the football or something or other, you know. And my experience is most teachers are on your side.
Yeah.
And, you know, if anything is going wrong, if you have a big concern, and that helps also as well, because you know, now a teacher does not have time to be looking out for 36 kids and ringing 36 parents. But, you know, if you have a concern, do say it. And also talk to your child. You know, and you know, one of the ways we can connect with our children is, now I know we were all with Noah in the ark as far as they're concerned,
but
you can talk about, I remember my first day in secondary school, or I remember junior school or whatever. And one of the things I found very hard was, what are you doing there? You're building a bridge. You're saying to your kids, I've experienced these emotions. Okay, the drapes might have been different, you know, the desks might have been different, but human beings are the same, you know, down through the generations.
Yeah.
And that whole experience of being afraid, being delighted, being concerned, whatever, you know. So when you do that, and the time to do that is not when they walk in the door, okay, the time to do that is when every young child wants to talk. And when is that time? Bedtime. Because they don't want to go to bed.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, well, perfect
so
time.
So push that into your diary and say to yourself, you know, maybe for the next week or two or whatever. It doesn't have to be every single night.
Oh.
But just raise a flag to yourself to kind of say, you know, and maybe on a Friday night when you don't have to be up early in the morning, I'm talking 5-10 minutes. I'm not talking an hour and a half.
You
know, and just kind of say, so you've had your first week in school. Or don't even say that. Say, I remember my first week in school. You know, I remember coming home to my mother and saying, you know, and even your teenagers, when they roll their eyes, you know, all that sort of stuff, it doesn't matter, you know. Mm. What is going on in the heart is not necessarily what is being advertised on the face.
That's right. Well done.
Okay.
Great. That's a lovely one, Katrina. Good, great place to finish. And you are bringing comfort. You know, even though they might be rolling their eyes at you, you're bringing comfort.
We will survive, guys. We will survive.
We will get through this. God bless you, Katrina.
God
Thank
bless
you so much
you,
for joining us this
God
morning.
Bless.
Most of us, at some stage or another during our lifetime, will find ourselves wearing either contact lenses or glasses as we suffer from failing eye health. For those aged over 50 in Ireland, the leading cause of sight loss is age-related macular degeneration, commonly referred to as AMD. On the line now to tell us more about the condition, we have Don Stack, optometrist and founder of the Optical Rooms, Ireland's first corporate-based opticians. You are very, very welcome to the show, Don. How are you?
Thanks, Warren. Appreciate it.
Yeah, first of all, Don, can you explain to us what exactly is AMD?
Well, age-related macular degeneration, as the words will tell you, it happens in later life. It's a degenerative condition. So just to explain what happens at the back of the eye, light will fall on the eye. It will cause a chemical reaction, which is transferred to an electrical impulse, which goes to our brain, and we perceive it as an object or sight or the view or whatever we're looking at. Now, the cells that does that processing over time can reduce their functionality for various reasons. They're less productive. The waste production that they make doesn't get taken away and allow the functionality to happen normally. So these are progressive problems that happen, and we're beginning to see that where we were seeing it perhaps in age profiles of 70 and 80 year olds, it's coming closer to the 50 mark.
Wow.
And that's really got to be, you know, attributed to our lifestyles. Obviously, we're very computer generated. It's a knowledge-based economy. We're using our eyes on a lot of digital devices. So we've much more exposure and much more challenging conditions around using our eyes than we had, say, a generation past. And that's really what's triggering the explosion now.
In AMD. So just from the point of view of the person who is experiencing a kind of a loss of eyesight, am I right in saying this is kind of a blindness that begins in the middle of the visual field? Is that right?
Exactly. So when you're looking at any detail, you're using a central area called the macula, and it's really kind of for very sharp pinpoint focusing. It's not the general picture. It's not the big images. It's when you're looking at somebody, you'll see the detail of their face. You're using your macula. And unfortunately, when that area goes, patients will see the general picture, they'll see the walk into a room, they'll see the furniture, they'll see all the details, but they won't see the small child on the ground, you know. So it's that kind of, it robs the central.
Absolutely. My mother-in-law actually ended up with a pretty severe case of this, and I remember she would literally kind of almost be looking out of the side of her eye at you by the end, you know, so she could see you.
Because if she goes off-center and off-macula, her retina is functioning at its best. Now, that doesn't allow great clarity. So when patients come in for an eye examination, you'll see them moving their head from side to side to try and read the chart. And what they're trying to do is go off-center to try and see and read the letters.
So I'm right in saying back in the day, it was people who were gardeners, people who spent an awful lot of time out in the sunshine. But now what you're saying is the increased use of tablets, of phones at night, all that kind of stuff, that's kind of upping the ante really for those people.
Yes, for sure. So it's the visible spectrum, obviously, that we can see with, right? So that hits the back of the eye. And actually, the front, we had a chat there some time ago about UV light. Well, UV doesn't actually hit the back of the eye. It gets blocked at the cornea. It gets blocked at the crystalline lens, which turns into a cataract if it gets enough of it.
Right.
But the visible spectrum is how we see. So it gets to the back of the eye. And the visible spectrum, patients will know that it goes from like the kind of indigo blue end right over to the red end. And when we were younger, we all used tungsten bulbs, and we were using the red end of the spectrum, which were low-energy, long-wavelength type of light. And now with the efficiency of LED lighting and computerization, we've gone to the other end of the spectrum,
okay,
the blue light.
Yeah.
And that's a high-energy, short wavelength, and it has a much bigger impact. So
on the eye, yeah, of course.
Clarity, very clear, exactly, and it looks great. But what's happening when that high energy hits the back of the eye, it causes this thing called oxidative stress on those cells, and it's those cells then degenerate. So the degeneration and the accumulation of the workload that it had due, which did take 7 decades in the past, is now being soaked and much ramped up at a much higher rate at younger ages. So it's problematic. I mean, at the moment, you've got 7,000 new cases of AMD a year in Ireland. They're expecting that to grow significantly because of the introduction of tablets and iPhones and digital devices at the younger age. So the amount of, we'll say, workload that the macula has had to do is going to be much more than it was in the last generation.
Yeah.
If you follow.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It makes a load of sense, actually. And I never heard it put in that particular way. And of course, it's another reason to get our kids off the iPhones. You know, it's really,
you know.
So is there a way, Don, is there a way of preventing it?
Well, yeah, the important point for patients, and usually we cover 4 points when we have a patient who we feel is in the high-risk zone. So whether a patient is a smoker now or in the past, that puts them in a high-risk zone because of the free radicals that you get from smoking. If people that have a history of it, there's a genetic link, and there's obviously, like a lot of diseases, you know, people have a genetic propensity, and then something triggers it, and they suffer from the disease. So it's a similar thing. If mom or dad has macular degeneration, your chance of getting it as their son or daughter is higher. And then at the back of the eye, where you'll see little fatty deposits, and usually what that means is that the cells that are processing the imagery and having byproducts and waste product, that waste product doesn't get taken away. So that's the functionality I was talking about of those retinal pigment epithelial cells. If they can't take away the byproduct of those chemical reactions, you get a buildup of these things called drusen.
Yeah.
And it's usually early stage macular degeneration where if it turns into wet stage, you know, you have a real problem. So we tend to say to patients, listen, that's another telltale sign. And then the fourth thing we look at is the actual retinal pigment epithelial layer thickness. So it's a bit like if you go out in the sun and you've got great melanin and you get a tan quickly and you protect your skin from burning. Well, this is like the same. At the back of the eye, you're going to have a thickness layer, and that's literally the barrier for you burning the back of the eye, being able to process all that imagery, etc., etc. If somebody has what looks like a patchy, or it's thin, or it's conjugated, it doesn't really look like it's functioning properly, we look at those 4 points. And then we step in and we say, listen, there's eye supplements out there, and that's really what you want to be looking at now as a preventive, because early diagnosis, early prevention, reducing the onset of it, these are all the only way to go, because once you get macular degeneration, you can't turn the clock back. You
sure.
Can't
and when you say,
there with treatment.
When you say eye supplements, what kind of things are you talking about?
Well, the one we use particularly is the leading European one, is Neutroph Total. And that really is for people that, yes, already have macular degeneration, but we'd also try, and really the drive is to prevent it. So we're looking at those telltale signs, and we would advise patients then, listen, this is a supplement that's good for your health generally. It has omega-3 and resveratrol, and we've seen a little bit recently about vitamin D. And the low levels of vitamin D we get in Ireland due to the erratic sunshine we get. And this has vitamin D in it, and it has these antioxidants. And antioxidants mop up free radicals. And free radicals are these toxins you get in from smoking or from the environment or from what we're eating. And they reduce the risk factor that they cause to the cells. So free radicals damage cells, and antioxidants mop up free radicals. So it's very important for patients that are risk or concerned that they will consider taking a supplement, which is nothing but beneficial for their body overall, but it certainly will be very beneficial for the back of the eye.
Absolutely. So, you know, I'm going to ask you, how often do you think people over 50 should get their eyes checked?
Well, you know, there are other considerations, you know, if they can't see what they're doing, but certainly every 2 years, we would try and encourage patients to do an annual eye check, you know, for the sake of what it takes, and they can do it on their PRSI, and it's usually just a time commitment rather than a financial commitment for a lot of people. So an annual checkup is part of their healthcare regime. It's certainly advisable, and then to be aware of the risk factors, you know, if they're a smoker, it's a no-brainer. They need to be taking a supplement, family history, like I say, early signs of a DFO, and then if they have like how it looks like a low propensity for dealing with the exposure to the light and that whole functionality of the cell, we would recommend people to go on those. It's a once a day supplement. Like I say, it's like somebody going on a multivitamin. It's the same thing. It is a multivitamin of sorts, but it has a specific eye related benefit.
Brilliant. So the kind of you, so what you're saying is you get your eyes checked with, you know, every year or two. Your ways of preventing in terms of supplement and that kind of thing. And I presume you're going to say watch the computer screens and mobile screens as well.
Yeah. So you can protect the eye. Obviously, you know, people wearing sunglasses if they are out in the bright day, or they spend a lot of time abroad, or they get a lot of sunshine wherever they get it from. That's one thing. You can do it either with a bit of hat or with sunglasses or whatever. You reduce the amount of exposure your eye gets. And certainly on the computer screens, we use this lens called a blue control, and it reduces the amount of blue light. Now, we need blue light to see clearly, and it's part of our imagery. But certainly by reducing it over the space of a day, a month, year, a decade, it's going to have a cumulative benefit to patients. So in the corporate space, we do a lot of on-site. We would recommend blue control lenses for 98% of office users, unless they dislike the toning. And it literally tones down. So you know yourself, in the evening time, the phone might change from a bright white image to a kind of a duller yellow.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Is that good?
And the reason they do that is because blue light affects our body in the lines that it's a stimulant. It tells
absolutely.
Our body it's daytime.
Wake
and,
up,
and
yeah.
Exactly. So it prevents sleep patterns.
Yeah.
From normal functioning. So it's the melatonin release that's the problem with that. So that's why that happened. With the blue control lens, it's effectively doing that all day.
Yeah, I had a quick look there. Nutrof, that's Nutrof total. It's about €15 for 30. And is that widely available, or is it...
Most pharmacies, you can buy them online. And it's a product that had a lot of research behind it. It's a very, very well-researched and very clinically proven model. So we use that as our first line of attack.
Yeah, brilliant. And AMD Awareness Week is coming up?
That's right. So the Association of Optometrists Ireland usually do road shows, so they go around different areas. There's a free screening. Well worth doing that if someone had the time. And some opticians will do it as well as a free service for the week. It's something people should be aware of, and certainly if it's in your area, there's no reason why you wouldn't avail of it.
Absolutely. Don Stack, good chatting to you again. Optometrist and founder of the Optical Rooms, Ireland's first corporate-based opticians. Thank you so much for talking to us this morning. And he is available at www.opticalrooms.com. Thank you. God bless you.
Thanks for now.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Our next guest found himself homeless and on the streets of Belfast when he was just a teenager. Now, he is a respected Christian pastor and a representative of the evangelical movement in Ireland. What happened in between? Well, Nick Park shared some of his life story in this week's Life in Five interview. What's that? Well, it's an interview where our guest shares about their life, interests and faith by answering five questions that they choose from a short list. This is Pastor Nick Park talking earlier to our very own Steve Johnson.
I'm originally from Belfast in the north, but I've been living just outside Drogheda now for over 25 years. I pastor the Solid Rock Church in Drogheda, and also I'm the director of Evangelical Alliance.
Uh-huh.
I'm married to my wife, Janice, and we got one daughter, Kirsty, and we've got a big old English sheepdog called Holly.
How many years are you married?
Married now 33 years.
33 years.
And it gets better and better.
Congratulations, and that's very encouraging to hear. It gets better and better. So you've chosen five questions. The first one, a person who had a big influence on you.
Okay. Somebody who had an amazing influence on my life was a man called George Hardy. George Hardy was a Salvation Army officer who ran their hostel for the homeless in Belfast.
Wow.
Back in the late 1970s, early 1980s. And my encounter with the gospel took place when I was homeless. I was living on the streets. I actually had paramilitaries seeking to shoot me in the kneecaps. And out of fear, I took shelter in the Salvation Army hostel.
What age were you in your teens?
I was 18 years old. I had been on the streets for 3 years.
Wow.
A terrible time. And I was there in that place, and I hated Christians. I was the most awkward person. I did everything I could because I had this theory that Christians were just pretending to be nice, and if I could provoke them enough, they would be really nasty
show
to me.
Show their true colours.
And I could say, oh, they're no better than me. I don't have to feel bad about myself after all. And this man showed such patience. You know, even after I gave my life to Jesus, and I didn't become perfect overnight, obviously, still haven't, still working on it. But I remember one time in particular where the temptation to go back on the drink was just so strong. Mm. And I went out and I went into the pub and I ordered myself a drink. And I'm sat with a drink in front of me and I hear a tap on my shoulder, and it's George Hardy from the Salvation Army who had followed me into the pub, took the pint, handed it back to the barman and said, he won't be needing that, and then led me out of the pub. And he said something to me that I've never forgotten. He says, Nick, he said, you might feel like you're back in the gutter again. He said, but you don't belong in the gutter anymore. This is never where you belong anymore. And he showed such patience whenever other people would have given up, that really, today, I just thank God for him.
Wow, that's amazing. Did he explain why he followed you that day? Did he have any particular reason to be concerned for you?
He just felt a prompting in his spirit. Now listen, I'm a Pentecostal pastor. I'm used to people talking and about having promptings in their spirit. Yeah. He was a Salvation Army officer, not a Pentecostal by any stretch of the imagination, but he just felt this tug in his heart that he had to go and search. And he had actually searched for me. I understood later that was not the first pub he went into looking for me. He had been on a pub crawl looking for me that day.
Looking for Nick. That is amazing. Your next question is a favorite Bible verse and why?
Okay, one of my favorite Bible verses is Proverbs 28 verse 1 that says, "The righteous are as bold as a lion." Because when I first gave my life to Jesus, I suffered from crippling shyness and embarrassment. And I was in a Christian church where I'd come from this background of alcoholism and homelessness. And I'm in this nice church full of middle-class, respectable people. And I just felt like I didn't belong. And I felt that people were always would be looking at me and judging me. And you know what? Even sitting in a church service, I would start feeling embarrassed. Not even speaking, just sitting there. Yeah. And I would start blushing. Huh. And you know when you start blushing, it's really hard to stop. The more you try, the redder you get. So I would be like bright red. And now everybody was looking at me. You know, they said, look at the guy with the red face. So I'm struggling with this crippling embarrassment and shyness. And I'm so aware that God is calling me to preach the gospel. And I'm thinking, but how could I ever speak to people when I can't even sit in a church?
Yeah.
I was reading the Bible. I read that verse, "The righteous are as bold as a lion." And I said, I'm going to have some of that. And God literally took away the shyness and the embarrassment. I can talk to anyone, anywhere, and I don't feel embarrassed anymore. So it's the power of the word.
And how do you find that in terms of, like, I know that you debate a lot with people as well, you know, and that takes courage and boldness too. Is that something that you found changed? Like, some people are just terrified of conflict.
Yeah.
So is that something that used to be the case for you and it now is not?
Well, I would always have been a classic conflict avoider. Yeah. You know, I'll do anything to avoid a row.
Yeah.
But to be honest, I don't go seeking conflict.
Yeah.
But I do relish the opportunity to speak truth and to listen to people that have different viewpoints and to respond to that. But I do find that does not produce anxiety because there's a confidence, and the confidence is not in myself. The confidence is in God and the power of his word.
I'm also interested in saying that this piece of scripture struck you. And after that, you found you had this new confidence, this new courage, this boldness. Did you read it and ask God for it, or did it just happen?
No, I read it. I actually, as a young Christian, because I'd come from a non-Christian background, I grew up basically as an atheist, and I didn't know the Bible. Once I gave my life to Jesus, I began reading the Bible, and I started Genesis chapter 1 and just worked through cover to cover. Yeah. You know, nobody told me you should start with the New Testament. I said, you start at the beginning of a book, off you go. And so I was continually coming up against new Bible quotations. I'd never heard them before. Yeah. And I just said, okay, I'm going to have that.
You owned it.
Yes. And it was a wonderful way to start off my journey with the Word of God, because it was just all fresh and all new.
All fresh, yeah. That's brilliant. Your next question is very different. How does God help you in your marriage?
Well, I've been married for 33 years, and I do mean what I say. That's not just a platitude when I say it gets better and better. And again, this is based on Scripture, because one of the prophecies of Jesus in the Old Testament says, of the increase of his government, there shall be no end. That's one of those ones from Isaiah that we always repeat it.
That's sung in
Christmas carol services.
Yeah,
and yes,
Messiah,
of course. Well, that means that if Jesus is in the center of marriage, it should get better and better. Sure. So our expectation for 33 years has not been that we go through a honeymoon experience and then things gradually go on the slide, but things get better as we get to know each other better. Yeah. And I think as well, in marriage, it's understanding and knowing that God created marriage as an illustration of his relationship with the church. Mm. Now, it's not that God says, well, I've got this relationship with the church, now I'm writing the Bible. What, you know, what, oh, I wonder what illustration I can use. Oh, I know, marriage. No, God created marriage in the very beginning, that it would serve that purpose. And so what I find really helps me in my marriage, and Janice as well, is to know that we're actually working out something that God created right at the beginning of the universe, that we can actually, in our marriage and the way we relate to each other, we can actually demonstrate to other people something of the reality of how God relates with his church.
So you have an expectation of that, and you found that it's not just an expectation, in practice it's the case.
It is the case, and it takes hard work, as does our relationship with Christ at times.
And I'm sure God's relationship with us. So your next question is, a favourite piece of music and why?
The one I've picked here is the great hymn, And Can It Be? Charles Wesley, Can It Be That I Should Gain an Interest in the Saviour's Blood? And here's the funny thing. I pastor a church which has a loud contemporary worship style. Yeah. But you know what? Personally, the songs that I most love to worship God with are the old classic hymns from hundreds of years ago.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons is because they are just packed full of scriptural truth. When I first became a Christian, and now I'm going back now 35 years or longer, you know, 37 years, in fact. When I became a Christian, at first, I didn't know anything, any doctrine. I didn't know any truth.
Yeah.
But I learned it from the songs that we used to sing. And so I love songs that are not just saying 100 times over, I love Jesus, isn't he wonderful, he made the stars in the sky. Now, there's a place for that. But I love the songs that are so packed full of truth.
Of truth and meaning.
And when I look at that song, I mean, just looking at some of the lyrics to it, you know, it says, he left his father's throne above, so free, so infinite his grace, and emptied himself of all but love. You know that this is the thing, that the Son of God made himself a servant, you know, like in Philippians.
Philippians 2, so it's unpacking some of those
scriptural
truths.
It's all there. It's deep theology.
Yeah.
It's expressed in song to a stirring tune, so I love it.
Your final question, the one thing that most people wouldn't know about you.
I keep tropical fish. It's a hobby that I have. I took it up a few years ago, maybe...
Not after watching Finding Nemo now.
No. No, what happened was my wife and I, we actually bought a friend a little 10-gallon fish tank from the pet shop. And they just never got round to setting it up. And in the end, they gave it back to us, said, look, I'm not going to use it. So Janice said to me, okay, we can't let this go to waste. Work out how to set the fish tank up. So I set up this 10-gallon fish tank, and for anybody starting off in fish keeping, it takes a while to learn it. The fish keep dying, you know, and I couldn't believe it. I thought, this is supposed to be relaxing. I'm totally stressed out because the fish keep dying. But eventually got the hang of it, and then I got a bigger tank, a 450-litre tank, 5 foot long.
Wow.
And I loved that. And then got a bigger one, got a 600-litre tank, and with this one, I actually measured the space underneath the stairs where the tank would go, but I forgot to measure the width of the doors into our house and had to not just take the doors off the hinges, but actually remove part of the concrete lintel over the door. So I'm under strict instructions now from Janice that there are no more fish tanks going in our house. But I keep these three fish tanks in the house. The fish breed and multiply, and, you know, huge array of brightly coloured tropical fish. And I find it a hobby that I just love.
Yeah.
I just love it. I actually watch television much less. I'm happier watching the fish than I am watching television these days.
That's Pastor Nick Park talking earlier to Spirit Radio Steve Johnson. And we will be continuing the Life in 5 series every Thursday shortly after 11. You may recall our interviews with Father Tony Coote last summer as he completed a 550-kilometre journey from Donegal to Cork. It was an ambitious walk for any person, but it was an extra significant achievement for him as he completed it following his diagnosis of motor neuron disease. The fundraising walk was called Walk While You Can, and following that he went on to write a book called Live While You Can, a memoir of faith, hope and the power of acceptance, which was a number one best-selling book in Ireland. It is with great sadness that we learned of Father Tony Coote's passing last night. On the line now we have Father Tony Coote's close friend, Father Declan Blake, parish priest in Ballymun, County Dublin. You are very, very welcome to the show, Father Declan.
Good morning, Ronan. Thanks.
First of all, Father Declan, from myself and all the Spirit Radio team, we send you our deepest condolences to you and, of course, as I said earlier on, to Tony's family and friends and his brothers and everybody on the news of the passing. First of all, Father Declan, you've been a long-term friend of Father Tony.
Yes, I've known Tony 34 years from our time in the seminary in Clonliffe College, and we've been very good friends ever since then, and we've always been in contact. So yes, I've known Tony really a long, long time.
Can you tell us a little bit about him as a person, as a friend?
Well, Tony was always a great character, a very friendly person, good to be around, great fun, you know, always enjoyed having the laugh, having a bit of crack. Over the years, we've met up every Sunday night for the past nearly 30 years. We've been meeting, you know, just four of us who were in college together. We've been on holidays many times over the years. But just a guy who loved life, lived life to the full, and always had, you know, ideas and plans and projects and so on. So he achieved a huge lot, really, in his life.
And tell us about, you know, the way he handled that diagnosis of the motor neuron disease.
Well, it was a very, very difficult thing. I know I spoke before on the show. When he was diagnosed, of course, it was a terrible, terrible shock for him and for everybody else, family, friends. But from the moment he was diagnosed, I met him that day after he'd been diagnosed, and immediately he was thinking positive. What can he do, basically, to live life to the full? What can he do, you know, as he copes with the illness? And one thing was that he organised the walk right through the country, as you mentioned, from Donegal to Ballydehob, raised over 800,000 at this stage.
Yeah, amazing.
He wrote his book there recently. The book launch was back in May, and it was all really to raise awareness of the illness and also to raise money for research and care for people with motor neuron disease, because there are only three nurses who were paid by church gate collections, not by the state. So he wanted to raise awareness about that and to raise money to try and get another nurse on board. So since then, another nurse has been employed full-time to care for people with motor neuron disease. But he was that kind of guy. He just wanted to try and change things, raise awareness. And as I say, he always had plans. You know, he was just a very positive guy. And he touched the lives of many, many people from his time in Ballymun Comprehensive School. Back in the early 90s, he was in UCD then for 9 years before he came to Mount Mary in Kilmacud parishes here. So he touched the lives of many people. I've heard so many stories, even since his illnesses, to how he encouraged people, how he got them to believe in themselves. He was just full of life.
And yeah, I'm very aware that this is a difficult time for you, and I don't want to push you beyond what you can cope with. But you know, I was really struck by, you know we're all about faith, you know, and we're always trying in some way to explain our faith to people. But there was something about the way he was able to get support, particularly, and he was able to do it in real practical ways, and people just kind of loved him, you know, they flocked to him, and in a way it was really kind of an amazing witness, really, of faith too, wasn't it?
He was great witness, and even as the illness progressed, and you know, he had big struggles really. He tried to have that positive attitude. He got out there. He didn't stay in the house. Even the fourth, this day 2 weeks ago, I got a message sent to me. Well, somebody sent me a message. He asked me, would I bring him shopping out to Dundrum Shopping Centre up the road here and to go to a movie afterwards? He was going into the hospice the next day, and but he wanted to buy his pyjamas for the hospice. But anyway, we went in around the shops, went to a movie, and even though he was quite ill, he was still fighting, you know, until the very end. So, but people just liked him. He just radiated positivity, I think, and love. He was never judgmental. He was very accepting of everybody. Everybody was always welcome. And that's just the type of guy he was.
And Declan, a final thought on him from your own point of view. How are you going to remember him?
I just remember him as being, you know, a good friend, somebody I could talk to. I'll miss him. We'd good crack together, you know, as I say, holidays and trips away and so on. But I suppose I'll remember him from as being that person who has always been just very inspirational. And even in the last few days here, as he was deteriorating, you know, as he was dying, he still tried to be positive, and he just fought till the very end. And he died very peacefully, 7:20 last night. We were here with him in the house, and his family members and close friends, and he just slipped away like a gentle breeze, and I think that would have been his wish.
Yeah. God bless him. Father Declan Blake, parish priest in Ballymun, Dublin. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Ronan. Take care.
God bless you. And if you'd like to reflect and listen back to Father Tony's interview with us last summer, we have shared it on our Facebook and Twitter page. A little quote from him: "I've always believed that I will meet Jesus face to face. I've never been worried about that." Father Tony Coote speaking to Spirit Radio last year. There is a classical music festival happening in Monkstown, County Dublin, from the 5th of the 8th to September. Now, it's in its 6th year. Music in Monkstown returns with a diverse series of concerts by some of Ireland's leading classical musicians, ranging from flute, solo, piano, string quartet and chamber ensemble performances. In studio now to tell us more, we have John Finucane, the founder of Music in Monkstown and the principal clarinetist of the RTE National Symphony Orchestra. You are very welcome to the show, John, and lovely
Thank
to meet
you, very
you again.
Much, we it's were just pleasure to be here.
We were just sharing the fact that we've probably known each other for years, kind of, but never properly been introduced.
I'm still trying to picture you that many years ago.
That's right. Just imagine me with more hair and about half the size.
Yeah, that'd be the same.
That's
so, yeah.
The way it goes, you know. So I'll tell you what I want to do. I want to actually just play a tiny little thing here first. I want to just go. It's a little piece that I wanted to actually just find. And yeah, there it is. It's so I'm going to just throw it on there and have a listen to this. Absolutely gorgeous.
It's
so beautiful. Joan Trimble's The Pool Among the Rushes, and it's yourself, John Finucane, on clarinet, and Elisabetta Blumina on the piano. So, first of all, John, can you tell us a little bit of... I'm going to leave it playing in the background, it's so gorgeous. Do you mind? Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how the Music in Monkstown Festival came about?
How it came about? Well, I've been living in Monkstown for, well, many, many years at this stage, and I just realised one day... I was actually walking down to the pub for a pint, and I was just realised that we don't have really any events in Monkstown. It's a very artistic area, but we didn't actually have anything. We had the annual Messiah for All in the church.
Yeah, the church, yeah. There,
maybe the other odd thing, but there was nothing concrete, nothing that you could sort of advertise as this is a Monkstown thing. So I just made the decision between my house and the pub, I'm going to start a little music festival. It was a crazy idea.
Wow.
But I walked into the pub and I instantly met a couple that I'd known for many years. And I mentioned it to them and I said, how would I get into the church to have a look, see, is it possible? Is it like, is the layout suitable? Because I'd not been in the Church of Ireland there before.
Sure.
And the lady said, well, David here, he's the verger. This is chance.
And it's a beautiful space, isn't it?
That they sort of set it up for me, really. Yeah. And I went in, had a look with Dave, and it just snowballed from there. I initially asked friends of mine who are great musicians to come along with the first.
I was going to say you were ideally placed in terms of a network. You know,
have a
everybody.
Network, not just in Ireland, was in Europe as well, and the other one in the States. So I just let it spread like that and try and increase it each year so that it slowly becomes a bigger and bigger festival.
It's very kind of extraordinary because I was just thinking when you do something like that where you do something which is kind of you attach to work, which is like something that happens somewhere else, and you bring it into your local area, it's a nice feeling, isn't it?
It is a nice feeling, particularly when all the hard work is over and the actual music starts.
Yeah. Exactly.
I hadn't realised a friend of mine, Finian Collins, the pianist, he's
at the Ross
Festival, which is later on this month, a couple of weeks' time. In fact, I'm playing at it this year.
Excellent. For him.
But he warned me, so you're going to start a music festival, I'll just warn you, emails. And my God, was he right. It's true, isn't it?
Yeah. Exactly.
But it's fun. It's fun. You feel you're getting somewhere, you're doing something. And I feel we're doing something for the community.
Yeah, exactly.
And not
yeah.
just for other yeah. concert goers that,
no.
that come from outside.
Yeah, it's for
area.
Your place. Yeah.
It's our place.
Yeah.
And I know like there are a couple of hundred locals who really appreciate it. And they come and tell us how much they appreciate it, how much they look forward to it now.
Absolutely. And you know, I think what you can do with a festival like this, you get people in who wouldn't necessarily go to every musical festival because it's their local place. So what's happening is you're kind of stretching them a little bit and they're kind of listening to stuff they wouldn't necessarily get to listen to otherwise.
I'm hoping that's the case.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
it's very hard to know. In my situation, my position, I'm either on the stage playing a few
yeah.
pieces, which I am this year,
sure.
as usual,
yeah.
or else I'm sitting at the back of the church, like basically counting how many people come in.
Yeah.
Am I breaking even?
Oh, no. I know that one.
So I talk to a few of them come and talk to me, and I talk to them, but it's very hard to judge newcomers. Who's yeah. a newcomer?
So tell us about the lineup for this year's festival.
This year, same lineup, same style of programming as last year. There's a Friday night, a Saturday night, and a Sunday night concert. Friday night is Hugh Tinney, one of Ireland's
beautiful
piano players.
Yeah, amazing.
Saturday night and Sunday night are both the Sacconi Quartet, which is a great quartet
okay.
from London. I'm joining them on the Saturday night for the Mozart Clarinet Quintet, and Emma Abate, an Italian Londoner, is coming to join them for the Schumann Piano Quintet on the Sunday night. And we have two Saturday afternoon programs at 3:30. I'm involved in the Saturday one. And a group of young musicians who mostly have come through the Academy, Royal Irish Academy of Music, doing a Baroque concert. They're starting out in their field of international, hopefully, stardom.
Yeah.
And they're going to give us a sort of an early Baroque quartet concert.
And you rate them?
I rate them all individually.
Yeah.
The third man is actually, the male member is David Adams, who's a well-established organist and harpsichordist in Dublin and accompanist in general. But the three girls are all, I think,
on their way.
They're on their way
to
stardom in this area, if not other areas.
Absolutely.
I've started one new thing as well. Is that there's a national competition with Freemasons, Irish Freemasons Musician of the Year Award. Last year's winner was a lady called Amy Gillan that I've known for many years. Offered from now on for the Thursday night concert will be one of the prizes for this. So Amy is coming to give her prize-winning concert on the Thursday night.
I just want to tell everybody who's been listening in, John did that entire thing without any notes. He knows the entire thing, everything that's on, the entire lineup. He has
play some of it
on his mind.
As well.
Now, I believe there's an early bird cushion concert as well.
That's an interesting one. This was just it was almost a marketing idea I had, actually, Yellow Pack. But I thought it was a good thing to do because it's an early bird €1 cushion concert is what I'd like to call it.
Yeah.
There isn't room on the poster for that long title. This year it's a harpist who will come along and introduce the harp, play a few little things, kids of various ages. Last year, even my own grandson got up to have a go on the xylophone. It was quite cool. And that's a single, it's just a 30-minute concert in the Knox Hall near the church.
For €1?
For €1. And
that's
in fact,
amazing.
If a little kid came along with €1 in a 3-year-old, 4-year-old, which happened last year, we can't really take the €1 problem. So in you go.
Yeah, in the Knox Hall there, which
but
is just, yeah.
Again, it attracts people that haven't been to concerts before.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, so I'm getting the feeling that you don't really need to have to be a buff, like a classical music buff,
absolutely
to attend this.
No,
that's not the vibe.
No, you know that anyway,
yeah,
don't
yeah,
you?
Yeah.
For instance, these days there's a lot in the papers about how music is a therapy.
Yeah,
music
sure,
can actually cure
sure, yeah.
you of singing in a choir. It can help prevent or ameliorate depression. The Mozart effect has been well known for many years for sort of, I don't know, combing
yeah.
your brain, calming
yeah.
you. So
yeah,
we're doing
absolutely.
Mozart 3:30 on Saturday. There's a Mozart trio. Just the power of music, particularly live music. It's not the same sitting at home with your headphones on listening to pieces. Live is different.
Absolutely, yeah. I don't know what it is. You know that my early experiences, like, you know, in probably would have been pre-concert hall, but probably the SFX or somewhere,
yeah,
where, you know, with somebody and the thing, and just the feeling the air move
yes.
in the room. Now, obviously, I was like an 8-year-old 16-year-old who loved music and went on to make his living in music. But I was so moved by the feeling that you could get in a room where people are really making music.
And it's hard to describe and explain, is it? It's a combination of what you see. You can see people actually maybe completely relaxed playing away and just an angelic look on their face playing the music. Or you can see somebody concentrating like crazy to really get the best out of the music. And this combination of what you see, what you hear also isn't usually as clinically clean as what's on a CD.
For sure.
And this is what's good about it.
Absolutely.
You hear the humanness, the humanity, and the realness of music when it's live. And the fact you're surrounded by another 100, 200 people or more having the same experience or similar experiences to you, that's something you can never recreate, and it's really good for you.
Yeah, it's so good for you. Yeah, like I love that when the air moves and it's just, oh, it's wonderful. So, and some jazz as well, I believe.
Oh, there is some jazz. My wife is actually involved in this. My Jana, my Polish wife. She's a superb jazz singer. Made a lot of work in Poland before she came over here as a wedding band singer and a gospel singer.
Wow.
She's there with her jazz trio, double bass, guitar, and herself. After Hugh Tinney's concert on the Friday night, the idea is that everybody moves to a local restaurant. 2 minutes walk away.
Yeah, which I mean, Monkstown is full of restaurants, so it's very handy that way.
So that's what that is. I'm trying to develop it into a sort of a festival club, which other festivals have, and bit by bit.
I want to get you to play because I have you here and you have it. But before you do, can you just tell us very quickly when it's on, where it's on, and where people can get tickets?
Okay, well, it's on next weekend, starting today's Thursday, so it's Thursday next week. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
5th, 6th, 7th, 8th
in the parish church, Monkstown County, Dublin.
Okay.
Tickets are available from Eventbrite in two of the local shops, Post Office and Hewitt's, and at the door. It's a large church, so there's usually no problem actually getting a ticket at the door.
Brilliant. And musicinmonkstown.ie is the website, and you can get all the details away.
Thanks, Ronan.
God bless you.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.